Good morning and welcome once again to our weekly Sunrise Project call. I am so happy that we are all here this morning in a safe space filled with love and compassion and our mutual desire to heal, starting with ourselves and our families. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Whew, we are in for a very special treat this morning with Charles M. Below, who is an op-ed columnist at the New York Times, and he's been there since 2008. He is also a political analyst on MSNBC and has been the anchor of Prime with Charles Below on the Black News Channel, a commentator and a repeating guest on CNN and Fox, among others. Charles is the author of the New York Times best-selling books, one, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, and two, The Devil You Know. Fire Shut Up in My Bones had been developed into an opera that premiered at the Metropolitan Opera. It's the first opera by a Black composer in the history of that institution. Woo, that's amazing. The Devil You Know inspired the upcoming HBO original documentary, which is called South to Black Power, which premieres in 2 days on November 28th. Again, it's an HBO original documentary called South to Black Power, premiering on November 28th. And that explores Mr. Below's bold theory on Black liberation. I must say that Charles M. Below is a fellow HBCU graduate from Grambling State University, whereby I might add that he graduated magna cum laude. Unlike myself, I was happy to get through, but he graduated magna cum laude from Grambling State University, who, if we follow HBCU football, Grambling sadly lost at the last second yesterday in the Bayou Classic. Tiny bit. But that's okay. Fellow HBCU grad, we love. And so Mr. Blow is going to share with us this morning so much. He has openly shared and spoken about his struggles with depression and grief and the importance of Black men openly talking about mental health. So as I open this morning, first let me just say, Charles, thank you so much for being here. It is an absolute honor and privilege to have you with us here this morning. I shared earlier how much I love your work. I'm a huge fan of everything you do and all of your conversations. So thank you for being here and welcome.
Thank you so much.
So I'd love to start with your book, talking about your book, the one that I first referenced, Fire Shut Up in Your Bones, because that book, from the first second I listened to it on Audible, from the first second that you start talking, it is a riveting story of your journey and looking back at a moment in time that you openly shared in the book. So I'd love to have you talk about that. And how did you get to the point where you were able to really deal with it and talk about it openly with your guests? And
Oh,
your,
so
I'm
can
thinking.
we narrow it a little bit? So what do we want me to know? What do you want me to talk about that book?
So the opening, where you talk,
The
you
opening.
open by saying, "Tears flew out of me from a walled-off place from another time, from a little boy who couldn't cry. He had held on to the hurt and shame and doubt for so long, balling it up in the pit in me that I never thought it would come out. Didn't think it would come out like this." And so, what I'd love for you to talk about is you had a traumatic situation as a little boy with an older cousin, and then it finally erupted into this moment when you were 20. So, if you could share that story and how you got to the place where you felt open enough to really talk about it.
Right. So the first thing that I will say about that book was that as a child, I had no support system or resources that would help me deal with trauma. The book is about what happens when that happens, how a child will try his or her best to deal with it on their own, and this is the journey of trying to deal with it on your own. And what I realized as an adult, as a writer, In my 40s at the time, I didn't have the language to even share or deal with it or describe it then, but I had it now. And so I was, for me, the book was a service to other children and other people who love those children and other adults who were those children when they were younger, to share language with them, to share, be able to share the experience with them. And so the opening scene is kind of a foreshadowing of the climax of the book, which is there is an incident of molestation of me by an older cousin, and I am trying to deal with all of my life. What does that mean? And what does that mean in relationship to a queerness that I'm not fully understanding at that moment? And is there a causal relationship? Has this person harmed me more than just the incident, but harm me for the rest of my life in that way that I view queerness as harm? And so that scene is the culmination of that because I'm convinced that he has in fact left a scar on me, and I'm viewing queerness as a scar at that point. And that I am crying, grieving it in that moment, and that I am homicidal in that moment.
And how did you come to grips with realizing that there was nothing wrong with you, that it was something that he had done to you? And how did you learn the language over time to be able to deal with it? Because you said that you didn't have the language to deal with it. Was it through therapy? Was it through other people?
It
Can
was
you
not through
share that?
therapy. I will say that. I mean, one of the things about my journey is that I've done therapy, but it has not been consistently done over my life. I've had period, I think there was one period of a year, one period of 2 years, maybe another period of a year. So it was very specific to a period in my life where there was change, and so I was trying to deal with the change that was happening. So I wasn't this particular part of me, I didn't deal with in that way. And I feel like everyone has their own journey, and so I was only sharing mine. So I'm not saying therapy doesn't work. Don't get engaged with it or therapeutics of any sort. Or it's just that wasn't what ha worked for me. And one of the things, the right after that scene in the climax, is me discussing how I move forward from it. And for me, it literally is to simply release it. Like it is like carrying bags, and I make a choice that I'm going to put these bags down, and that they will stay there, and I will continue to move forward from them, and that is not me. The person that
That's right.
the entity that moves forward is me. I am not forever harmed. This does not hang on me like a shadow or a stench. I am a separate person from this one little moment in this one bit of time in my life. It cannot attach itself to me. And so I just make
That's
that
right.
choice as a person. Not everyone can make that choice. For some people, they need a moment with the abuser. They need the person to hear their pain. They need some people need the person to acknowledge that they inflicted the pain. I needed none of that. I did not want to ever talk to him again. We were fine. You are a part of my past. You don't have a power.
Call me.
You do not have the power to linger in my life. And that was a choice that I made.
That's wonderful. I am so many people don't have the strength to do that. And so I love that you did, and you said, you don't own me. This is a part of my life in the past. Who I choose to be moving forward is this strong and my truth and my journey. And I love that. I want to ask you about the op-ed that you wrote last year called Death Changed My Life, where you talk about your struggles with depression and how your older brother's death prompted you to reconsider the life you wanted to lead. And so first, I want to acknowledge and say I'm so sorry for your loss. And I'd love for you to share a little bit more about your mental health journey and how your life has changed since your brother's passing.
So from a I have four older brothers,
Okay.
and my father was distant and a philanderer and all the things, but he was never mean. I will say this, like this is a very interesting thing. I've seen people who had abusive parents. The harm he did was not physical, it was not aggressive, it was in a lack of engagement, and that can be its own harm. But in all of this craziness and chaos, and he and my mom separated when I'm 5 years old, and now she's a single parent with all these boys and also a caregiver to an older to her uncle. It is no fault of hers, but she's just trying to keep us all alive and healthy, and so she's working all the time. And in the scrum of it all, I'm just kind of, I feel almost invisible and left out. Like I feel very much fed and cared for. I just don't feel like anyone is paying attention. And I kind of sink into a world that I create, my own space. And in the shrinking, and this is the thing about children like that, if any of you have children who you see are kind of withdrawing and they kind of live in their own space and kind of apart from others, well, predators see that too. And they target children like that, withdrawn children, because the withdrawn child is also less likely to discuss what has happened to them. They're less likely to be believed if they do talk about it. So they target the withdrawn child. And for children, they can be confused by, or and I think society as a whole can be confused by this. They think that, that the incident of abuse makes the child different, where in fact, because the child was different, he was chosen by the abuser. And so that makes it worse for me in the isolation of it all, and not feeling like you can say anything. And it's not because anyone had ever said you could say anything. This is another thing that I always tell people about this issue. A lot of times parents will say, if this ever happened to my kid, I would do this to the person and that to the person. That never, ever, ever say that. It is, if you ever read Why the Caged Bird Sings, this is why Maya Angelou stopped speaking for years. It is because she says that the person has abused her and the person winds up dead. And she assumes that it is her words that have the power of death. That because she said something, this person who was intimate to the family is now removed from the family, dead. That she has scarred the family. And I think a lot of children carry that weight, particularly when they have heard the parents say, I will do this and I will do that and I will do that. And all they think in the moment is, if I say this, this rips the family apart because my mother or father is going to do this and do that and do that. And maybe if I'm old enough to even understand the concept, I will lose that parent because they're going to be in jail. So the children say nothing. Not because they are afraid of you, but they are afraid of what you will do. Right? And so I'm kind of all over the place here, but one of the things that I recognized that very early as a parent, and I created what I call safe space. It was my office. And I said, this is safe space. Whenever you need to want to talk or yell or cry or scream or tell me that I'm wrong, you come say, Dad, can I go into to our safe space? We go into the office and they yell, they cry, we had
That's
tissue,
awesome.
whatever. But if I, as long as they had not been harmed and no one else to who they were talking about has been harmed or harm was imminent, it all stayed in that space. And having a space where a child feels comfortable, validated, they can say things and it doesn't harm everyone, that was really important. And they really accessed that all the time.
That's awesome. And your kids are grown now. So
Right.
they did that. You did that when they were little?
Yes,
How
all
old
of
were
them.
they? their whole lives.
They've been doing that since they were little babies.
That's wonderful.
I mean, yell at dad, you can do it in here.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. I think that's so fantastic because, yeah, go ahead, please.
But I say that to say, that was, but the mental health part of it was, the isolation was severe, and I got to the point where loneliness became like the other friend, like it was the person, it was the constant. And so, and I don't know if I were, it was clinically depressed, it felt depressing, and it certainly was lonely. And that I got so comfortable with that being in my life and part of my life that it was part of my life when I was older. And when it was around, I was comfortable with it being around. Like I understood it, and it was familiar to me. I was going to talk to about it like it was an old friend, and it went into adulthood, and it manifests. I think it manifests for people in different ways. We often think about it as manifesting in a person when their behavior creates negative impacts on their life. Look at your overachievers too,
Absolutely.
because a lot of us become overachievers because we are compensating for the negative. We are trying to erase it by achievement.
Absolutely.
And, but in doing that, the overachiever adds extra stress onto them. So they're carrying both the depression and the stress of, carrying all the load, and it becomes even more isolating. And so it can look, and we've seen these incidents of particularly Black people who are highly successful and then they commit suicide because we could never connect the stress of the stress or depression with a person who is succeeding. But a lot of times they're succeeding because they're trying to erase,
Compensate.
they're compensating, it's compensatory. So I've had to recognize all that. And one of the things that happened after my brother died was, I just asked myself, like, what life do I want to live? Do I want to live? Like, it's literally because some of the behavior, I'm just drinking too much. Like, some of the behaviors are so negative that the impacts can be life-threatening in the long run.
That's
Maybe
right.
not immediate, but it's life-threatening in the long run. And now I often say to myself, I think about the fact that he didn't live a very long time. And I imagine, like, so if life is this short, then how do I want to live it? And what decisions do I want to make? And what kind of mental or what level of peace and joy do I want or insist on having? And what does that look like? And it shifts the prism through which you see things a bit. And I think it's been very therapeutic for me, in a way.
Through the death of your brother, you have claimed this is the life I want to live, and I'm choosing to live. Number one, I'm choosing to live, and I'm choosing this type of life for the rest of my life.
Yes.
Correct? Is that what I'm hearing? I
Yes.
love that. I really want to just double click on something that you said that I personally feel. First, we all wear this mask, often. And two, people can choose to be habitually busy. And like you said, it's like being habitually busy can be an addiction. Like people can drink or people can be busy, and there's no glory in working 18, 20-hour days and sitting at the computer all day. But there's a similarity in terms of an addiction, an addictive behavior that's masking or that's doing something to not deal with whatever the painful situation is. So it's interesting. I think you mentioned that. I can personally relate to that on every level.
And a lot of times we get into addiction because we're just self-medicating. We simply can't. That was the thing that I had to remember or relearn, which
That's
was
right.
that, so drinking became, it just was a way to to flatten things out a little bit. Like,
Right.
not only could I not deal with the, you know, ups and the bads in life, I couldn't deal with all the success either. Like, it was, everything felt so overwhelming that I just need to flatten it out a little bit. And what I had to say, had to first is recognize that's what I'm doing. I'm doing that all the time. I'm doing it when I'm busy, is that I want to deal with emotions and all the ups and downs of emotions. When I am drinking a self-medication because I don't want to deal with the ups and downs and all of the emotions. And you have to say, I'll build the muscle to sit with your emotions. This
That's
is scary.
right.
This is scary. I'm going to sit with it and deal with it. This is overwhelming because I don't deserve this amazing thing that's happened to me. Sit with that and deal
That's
with
right.
that. This is too much grief. Sit with that grief, deal with that grief. And when I say relearning, you know, this was just a mental thing that I could, a device that I could use. You couldn't drink when you were a child. Horrible, you know, things up and down things. You dealt with, you went to take the, go to sleep. You wake up, it's better.
That's right.
Like, you will be fine. You will get
That's
over
right.
it. All of your life, you've gotten over it. You'll be fine. Relax.
Absolutely. I love that. It's like sit in the pain. I also, someone just shared with me recently that addiction, whatever it is, being over, working too much or drinking, drugs, whatever it may be, they said is the relief to the pain. There's the pain. It's a relief. And you said that's like a numbing, it's slowing down. It's it's using something without acknowledging and really dealing with, like you just said, sitting in it and dealing with it. Because when we finally acknowledge it, feel it, and talk about it, then we can move forward. I think that's so powerful. So thank you for sharing that. I want to also just acknowledge there are people commenting. Someone just said, good Lord. Hold on 1 second. Sitting with the grief instead of self-medicating is no joke. That's so true. And the self-medicating, like you touched on, which is powerful. It could be drugs, it could be alcohol, it could be being addicted to being busy and, constantly doing something to just not sit still. So, someone else that says, Mr. Blow, thank you for your voice and for sharing your journey with us as you came to the stage in your life when you could say, I am not forever harmed. Do you know if your family members who couldn't protect you were able to, or how did they heal?
I don't know. And you know, I am 53. I have released a lot. And I don't and I don't and I've just I've determined that for at least for myself, I don't need a lot. What I need is the forgiveness of myself. I need for myself to have clarity about where I am, what matters, what brings me joy. What brings me peace. And I don't need my family to have a, we don't have to sit around an oak table and have a meeting about it, you know. They are aware, you know, it's it I think for my mom is generational. It's just, you know, she's it's
Absolutely.
not, it is, I've had to accept that it is a difficult thing for her to know.
That's right.
That a child of hers is harmed in her house,
That's right.
and that I didn't feel safe or comfortable enough to tell her about it. And I, you know, so I have no judgment of her about that. I don't need her to discuss it and talk about it. I need myself to understand people and have empathy for them. And I think about how devastated I would be if I had found out, or if I ever do find out that my own children are harmed in my house while I am there. They don't tell me. You know, and I think a lot of what the wisdom of aging gives us is empathy.
That's right.
It wasn't my father was very much an alcoholic. And distant and all the things. And it wasn't until I wrote that memoir that I could understand him because I had never sat with trying to understand him. I was only upset or angry that I had not had more of him. And but when I had to consider his life and write it down, I had just a tremendous amount of empathy for him. The only family, as you know, kind of nuclear family, stable, together family he'd ever had was the family he had with us. And he destroyed that. And it destroyed him that he destroyed it. And when I thought about it, because I had to write about it, a tremendous empathy for that. You know, he just had never known. He had never known what family should be, what it should look like, how it should operate, how, I don't know how much he was hugged. I don't think that hugging was part of him. I don't think that the expression, emotional expression, was part of him, because his life had been so different. And so I think that for me, allowing people to live their lives and express their emotions and pains and whatever as they choose is part of growth for me, and part of my own peace. I think that when we put expectations on other people, first of all, they can do nothing. Very often, they can do nothing but disappoint us, because we have said, "This is what I need you to do, and why can't you do this to make me feel happy and whole and whole?
That's right.
It was your responsibility to protect it." No, I don't give you any of that. This is none of this is your fault. This is a person did something in a moment. What is it now? Like 40 something years ago, I am not about to hold anyone accountable for, including myself, for what someone else did
That's right.
40 years ago. That's not going to happen. So we
That's
are,
good.
allow me to express this, and I am expressing it not only for me, because I feel like personally that incident I've dealt with just through my life. I wasn't doing it to be cathartic for myself. That was really something I was giving to other people, because I knew that I could write it, and I knew I could. But let me do that. That is part of my exhaling, and it's long, and we all move forward, having ha I've done what I needed to do. If you need to say something or do something, say it. If you don't, I'm okay. I love you, and we are fine.
I love you and we are fine. And I think that sentence is so simple and so profound, because I also think realizing that every human has their own journey, and as a parent, the hard part is getting out of the way of our children's journey, particularly if that journey is going down a different path than what we had prescribed, from birth, or if they're making choices that might be different choices than we're making. I mentioned earlier my 21-year-old who goes to Boulder, left last night. Don't know where he is. Pray that he's fine, and I have faith that he's fine. I have faith that the doorbell will ring any moment. And that faith over fear and allowing him to walk his own journey has been one of the most challenging parts of my life as a parent, because we make, we can see some of the choices, not great choices, but what you said that's so powerful and so true is they have to walk their own journey. They have to walk their own path. And we as a parent have to allow that to happen, even when it's uncomfortable or scary or hard. So thank you for sharing that. And it's true of our children and also others that we love, where we can see, that's certain choices, but it's also for ourselves. Like we have to learn ourselves. So thank you for sharing all of that. I'm moved, as you can see. You also talk about some of your own struggles as a dad. You shared some of the positive and the safe space in the office, which I love. Well, can you share? Did you ever have any struggles as a dad? Because we're all here because we are working through it, working through it. We're works in progress.
Well, I mean, I am lucky that I didn't have to be any sort of behavioral issues with my children. Me and their mom separated when the oldest was six and the twins were three. And that was hard for them. When families split, that is just hard on children. It's hard on everybody. So they had that. I've described in my writing that parenting is like giving a hug. It's all about love and pressure. And sometimes we squeeze too tight. And
That's right. That's right.
and I was one of those parents. And
Yeah.
part of my relationship with my adult children is me, is them having the language to say, your emotion regulation is good today. They'll say stuff like that. They're like, oh, you haven't always been that. You would yell, you would be explosive, you know what? But my, part of parenting for me was that there was an always an expectation that you would do the right thing, that you would always excel, and I put a lot of pressure on them to do that. I think that they rebelled from that against that pressure later as they became teenagers and young adults. And I realized, well, I will say this. Give yourselves a break.
Absolutely.
There's no perfect way to parent. There's no, there's no handbook. And if there was a handbook, it would have to be written every time for every different child. There is no, there are some
That's right.
universal things
That's right.
about child development, but like every child experiences that differently. And you have to experience, you have to parent each child different. So anyone with multiple children, you understand this. Like, everyone's different. Like that first one, I did this, but this one I have to tweak it because it doesn't work exactly
Absolutely.
with the next one. So the first thing is like give yourself some grace because parenting is not clear and it is not direct and it is not follow the leader and whatever the next parent did, I can do it, just copy it, cut and paste. None of that's true. So we're all learning on the job. We're raising children as we are raising ourselves. And so all of that's happening. So I look back on it and I just say, I hope that on the on balance, I did better than worse. Like I did,
Absolutely.
that's the best I could do. And so that has been their journey. And so, I am very happy that they did that they embraced an ideal that first that they would try to always do the right thing. And that was not always easy for them. It really caused them some stress because teenagers don't always do the right thing. And the kids who do are outcasts. And so they were sometimes outcasts because of it. But generally speaking, I am blessed to say that that they have come into adulthood, not without challenges, but in a way that they can process and deal with their challenges, and that they know that we don't still have the same office, but hopefully they understand that we still have safe space.
Safe space. Yes, there's a book called The Invisible String that I love, or I used to read to the boys, that talks about no matter where we are, you're still right there, whether it's the physical office or in spirit or pick up the phone and call, as I'll always answer. I love that. And I love give ourselves grace. Because we're doing the best we can, all of us, all of us. And I love what you said about hopefully more better than negative, more good than bad. And so I appreciate that. And someone just said it took me so long to learn that my emotional regulation impacts my sons more than anything. Ooh, yes, absolutely. So thank you for sharing that. I want to make sure that we have time for people to ask you questions. And so if anyone has a question, you can hit star six to come off of mute, or if you'd rather type it in the chat, feel free to do that. I would love for you, before I turn it over to our guest, to talk about your film that is coming out
Yes.
in 2 days. Congratulations on that. So if you came a little late this morning, Mr. Blow has an incredible film called South to Black Power. It premieres on November 28th on HBO. I'm going to get HBO just so I can see this. We don't have
Yes,
HBO, but we're going to get
that
HBO.
helps.
Get HBO, download it. It premieres on Tuesday. And so, can you share about the film? What it's
Yes.
about? Just give
Does
us your perspective. I'm super excited to see it.
South of Black Power premieres Tuesday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on HBO. And it is developed out of my second book, which was called The W Note. And the premise is simple, which is that after the Civil War, three Southern states were majority Black: Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina. And three others were within 8 percentage points of being majority Black. In fact, 90% of all Black people lived in the American South, who lived in America. And because of that, they had just tremendous success and ability to move legislation and change state constitutions to increase Black representation, power, and equality. And that happened during Reconstruction. And then there were, Jim Crow began to rise. But one thing that also removed that potential for that Black power was the Great Migration. People moved out, 6 million people, almost half of the Black population of the South moved out of the South to cities in the North and West. And what I say is that I make a proposition. Reverse that. There's cities, there are states in the South that are have very, very high percentages of Black people, and increasing that increases Black America's political power because it increases their state power. There's a reason that the United States of America, because states have half the power, and in fact, they have almost all the power of the things that Black people say they care the most about: criminal justice reform. That's a state issue. That's the criminal
Absolutely.
encounter is mostly on a state level. Mass incarceration, mostly state local issues. So just a lot of things. So it is about reverse
Education, the
education,
books we can
healthcare
have.
policy, all sorts of things. So it is about encouraging people to move back to the South, but also just sparking a conversation about place and power for Black people.
I cannot wait to see it. And it is Tuesday night on HBO. So if you don't have HBO, get HBO. I don't work for HBO, but support Charles Blow and this fantastic film that I know is going to be amazing. I love the notion of reverse migration, and I love the thought of, moving back to where we were when we had power and so much more power and changing, looking at Florida, looking at some of these states that need
Although
major
Florida's not on my
change.
list. Florida's not on my list.
Florida's not on your list. Okay. But imagine if Florida had a bunch of Black people who could change the tide. I'm just saying. You can tell I like Florida, but I don't like the politics there. But we're not going to talk all of that. I would love to thank you for sharing that. It's going to be
Absolutely.
amazing. Tuesday night, 10 p.m., South by Black Power.
Off to Black Power.
South to Black Power. Thank you so much. I wrote it South to Black Power and then I typed it wrong in the chat. South to Black Power. So thank you. Is there anyone on the line that would like to ask a question of Charles M. Blow this morning? Feel free to come off of mute if you would like. I want to make sure we have an opportunity before we finish this morning. Any questions from anybody? Because if not, I have more. There is a question. Can you speak on any national leaders who seem well equipped to help Black people heal from the roller coaster of the past 15 to 20 years and make a better day? Can you speak on any national leaders who seem well equipped to help Black people heal from the roller coaster of the past 15 to 20 years and make a better day?
So I will assume that 15 to 20 years, so that's election of Obama, then election of Trump, and session
Imagine that's
COVID, George Floyd. I'm trying to figure out what that time period encompasses. It's an interesting question, but I don't fully understand the question because there is the Uber consideration, which is that there is intergenerational trauma that has existed for 400 years, right? That there's something in the culture that is being transmitted and then reinforced by society as it exists when it is transmitted, that has created a long-term cultural trauma. Then there is there are the real bracing new traumas, what this psychiatrist called what do they call it? Vicarious traumatization. So it was that because you could see in the last 20 years or so, maybe even longer than that, Rodney King probably the first one, Black people on video played over and over and over again being killed or hurt. But you were vicariously experiencing that trauma as if it were you or a family member. And so that is a visceral thing that's happening now that's not necessarily related in the same way to history. So there's a lot of different ways that we could describe a community or racial trauma existing within Black community. But my take on this is not necessarily comes from the therapeutic side of it, which is completely legitimate. It's just not where I have any sort of expertise or ability. My take on it is to deal with it as I am dealing with it in the film in the last book, which is that you have to change the power structures, because until you do that, the people with the power to traumatize you will retain the power to traumatize you. And so you can treat that, but you can also treat it by preventing it. And I think prevention is treatment, a better treatment. And so I am trying to create power structures that prevent the traumas from the in the first place.
I love that. And it's changing the power structure in those key states in the South. So it's the reverse migration starting there and changing the state politicians.
Which for me could help to change the country. And I look
That's
at it
right.
this way. We've only ever had 10 Black senators in the entire 11, I think, entire history of the country. The first one elected by a coalition led by Black people happened in 2020. Raphael Warnock in Georgia, led by Black people, because Black people had migrated back to Georgia around Atlanta, and they had enough of them, and Stacey Abrams had enough of them to organize, and she got them registered to vote, and they went out and voted. And now you have a Black man, a Black senator elected by Black people, responsive to that Black electorate. Never before.
Right.
Every other Black senator was elected by coalitions led by white people. They were responsible to that. You could see it in language and the posture that they were trying to make sure that they didn't go too far and offend that electorate rather than going as far as they could to defend us. And if you have enough Black people in states, you get more Raphael Warnocks. People elected, look like you, by you, responsive to you. And that changes the Senate itself. That's
That's
huge.
right.
That's a structural change. So when you look at why didn't we get police reform, it died in the Senate. You had more people in there who looked like you, voted like you, thought like you. You wouldn't have died.
Yep. The
You
Crown Act. The Crown Act, creating
think
a
about
respectful home for natural air, died in the Senate.
all the things that you could have
All
done.
the things. All the things. I know here in Maryland, we have a Black woman running for Senate. Also Brooke, is that her name? Ali, Allison, Angela, also Brooks, Black woman running out of PG County against a man who's a billionaire, David Trone. So we'll see. I'm gonna just put that aside. But I agree
Yes.
with you on the need to look at who our political leaders are. If we want to change, it's at the state level. So critical
And
and getting those state level.
That is a downplay for therapeutic treatment of trauma. I have nothing against that. I think it, I think any negative feeling people have about therapy is crazy. Like it is
It's
another.
critical, I think.
I think that all the ways that we have learned to treat, I think the brain is a magical, amazing thing, but it is so complicated, beautiful, and mysterious that it can also hold on to the negative and the weighty, and we just have to find ways to deal with it. And some people, we before we had therapy as we knew it, we had religion. We created religion because we needed something to help us to deal with it because everything was too big to think about. And so we did a thing way to put it there. We now have other means to do the exact same thing, which is therapy. I understand the brain. This is what it's doing. This is why it's processing in this way. This is why you are processing in this way based on your experiences, conditions, and whatever. And so we have tools. Use your tools. Why wouldn't you use
That's
your
right.
tools? Right. So I don't have
Right.
anything against therapy. I just want to think about it also from a structural point of view.
Yes.
And I want to prevent the trauma in the first place, in addition to treating the trauma after the fact.
Love that. Preventative measures, in addition to treating after. And I do agree with you that I think having multiple tools, I think therapy can be a wonderful tool and very helpful for many of us. So I wanted, there's another comment, question. It says, when and how did you share your life's trauma and journey with your children, your three children?
When I had a rough draft of my book, we have whenever something big happening in our family, we would have family meeting. We'd sit down at the table and we'd talk about it. Someone had died or something, and we'd do it. Then we'd big move. We would think contemplating moving or something. And we'd sit and have a family meeting, and they were little kids, but that was that we'd have a family meeting. And when I had a rough draft of the book, I sat them down. Told them what was in the book, what my life experiences had been, that I had written them down, and they were old enough to read the book at the time. And I gave them all their own copies of the rough draft. And I said, if you have any questions about what you read, I'm willing to talk about it. We can, and my oldest son, well, first of all, these are modern kids. So the first thing was like they were like, oh my God, I have struggled with this and that. That was part of me. I'm like, wait, what? So I'm thinking, I'm just like getting, telling my thing. And they're like, oh, and I had this, and you know what? Then they were just sharing their those that they thought were comparable to mine. And then my oldest son, who is the fastest reader in the family, he read the entire thing that night. Which is crazy, but he read the entire thing, and then he came and I said, I want to talk to you. I said, okay, and he says, I don't think you developed my mom's character enough in the last chapter. I was like, I don't need editorial notes. I have an editor. I want to know if you have like, do you is there like an emotional thing we need to deal with? So it was like an editorial note. It was so they had,
That he's like, can you fix it before it's published?
exactly.
Oh, I love that. It was in the book in your rough draft. That's wonderful. I love, love, love it. And then they started sharing even more. That's wonderful. Someone says, I agree that therapy is essential in growing and healing. Any other questions anybody on the phone would like to ask directly? If not, I want to ask one more thing around mental health. Are there any improvements you can think of or anything we can do as a community to improve?
I have to go now.
Okay, I hope everything's okay.
Yes, I have another MSNBC hit. Sorry.
You need to go do that. Thank
All
you
right.
for being here this
All
morning.
right.
Really appreciate you.
Thank
Take
you.
care.
Bye.
Thank you for everything. So, with that, we will close it out with a prayer from Charles M. Blow. And you see that he's probably about to be on MSNBC Live right now. So that's, we can switch over there and hear what he's talking about. But please check out his film on HBO on Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. Thank you for being here again this morning. We'll be back next week with Kelly Chapman, who will be joining us again to do a sunset session, which we do once a quarter or so. So I'm going to turn it over to Tiara to close us out with a prayer this morning.
Morning. So, Father God, we thank you for another Sunrise Sunday. We thank you for Kelly and family for providing this platform. We thank you for Charles Blow for sharing his deeply personal and inspiring story with us today. We thank you for his reminder that we are not forever harmed. God, we thank you that each day is a day filled with new grace and new mercy. Each day we have a chance for a new start, God. We thank you for the opportunity to make ourselves new by giving our cares and casting our cares onto you, Lord. We thank you for your transformative power. We thank you for each and every person in this village and their families. We pray that you bless them. May they have a peaceful, powerful, positive, and productive week. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you, Tiara. I appreciate you as always. Thank you, everybody, for being here this week. And we will be back next Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern. Have a wonderful, peaceful, relaxing day.